The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder if Christians should be involved with political arguments or any arguments at all, for that matter. Isn't arguing against the Spirit of Jesus Christ, aren't arguments unloving? Well, my friend, there's actually nothing wrong with an argument. Granted, an argument should be civil and can be civil, but they certainly weren't forbidden in Scripture or conflated with being unloving. Sometimes there's such a thing as tough love. Sometimes there's such a thing as loving somebody enough to speak the truth. Jesus got into arguments all the time with two major religious parties of his day, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Stephen was the very first Christian martyr. Do you know why he was killed? He gave a debate so convincingly that his opponents, unable to answer him, stoned him instead. But one man standing in the crowd was positively affected, Paul, who later became known as the Apostle Paul. And the Apostle Paul got into arguments all the time, so did his disciple Apollos. I'm reading about Apollos from Acts 18:28. For he rigorously refuted his Jewish opponents in public debate, proving from the Scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah. So yes, the Bible does encourage debate. Now, there is an exception. The Bible recognizes that logical arguments are lost on those who cannot or will not think logically, who instead react only with emotions or follow the pack. And so we read in Proverbs, and I'm reading here from Proverbs 26:4, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him." So no, you should not debate a fool. Why? Because it's a frustrating waste of time. Take, for example, those who attempt to argue against people who have decided not to support President Trump, no matter what he says or does. Here's a sample dialogue. Look at his impressive record so far. He has many achievements in the economy and so many other places. Oh, yeah? Well, I don't look at what he does. I listen to what he says. Like in all of those horrible tweets last year and during the election year, when he tweets, he doesn't sound presidential. Okay, then look at what he said during the State of the Union address. That certainly sounded presidential. Well, yeah, sure, if you're going to bring that up, but he only sounded presidential because he was on a teleprompter. Didn't Obama use a teleprompter? And didn't Trump say, whether scripted or not, that he was calling for unity? That we are all Americans, regardless of race or background. Just words. His actions do not suggest that he really feels that way. Well, I'm glad to see you're now ready to talk about actions. Returning then to the economy. Our economy under Trump has dropped unemployment for African Americans and Hispanics. Yeah, well, that doesn't mean anything because he doesn't really care about them. The man is a racist. What has he said that's racist? Tons of things. Can you name at least one example? Well, for one thing, he's talked about the M13 gang as if all dreamers are in a gang. He never actually said all dreamers are in a gang. Well, no, not in so many words, but he said all Americans are dreamers. Pretending for a moment that this is not a sleight of hand attempt to change the subject about gangs, isn't that true that all Americans are dreamers? How does the designation dreamer for legal citizens show disrespect for dreaming illegal citizens? I'll tell you why. Because he co-opted that term to rub it in the nose of children of undocumented workers. How do you know his motive? He would claim otherwise. I don't listen to the claims of racists. Oh, I thought this was about his words. How do you know his words if you are not listening? Well, right now I'm listening to you and I don't like what I'm hearing. You will notice that I did not call the undocumented workers illegal. It's wrong to call them illegal. And when you do so, you show your own racism, which is probably why you voted for Trump. So if the man is surrounded by racists like you, he must be a racist no matter what he says. I will resist the temptation to ask why calling a situation what it actually is makes somebody a racist, especially when so many legal Hispanic citizens also have a problem with illegal immigration. But whatever you choose to call the people who crossed our borders while breaking the law, President Trump's latest proposal would allow them to stay and also offer a pathway to citizenship. Isn't that just exactly what everybody has wanted? Not if we're going to tie it to a wall. The wall is proposed so as not to repeat this problem in the future. No, the wall is on the agenda because the man is a racist. So it's not about saying something racist. It's an action you deem racist. Sure, I don't go by what he says. I go by what he does. But what he does is allow them to stay. How is that racist? That may be what he proposes, but he really doesn't want them here. What are you basing that on? Things he has said about them in the past. What was the racist thing he said in the past? That he wanted to build a wall. But again, the only reason he wants to build a wall is... Oh, never mind. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Bible said it long ago. Do not argue with a fool. On the other hand, foolishness does need to be pointed out, such as the latest bipartisan proposal by Senator John pat himself on the back for his willingness to reach across the aisle, McCain. President Trump, just do the things the way Democrats want it done. And while you're at it, why don't you simply bend down and kiss Schumer's behind? No wall, continued chain migration, the works. Then at long last, we can have bipartisanship. What exactly will make it bipartisan? The fact that we call it bipartisan. More importantly, my reputation as the nice guy in the Senate will remain intact. And after all, isn't that what it's really all about? Okay, if you would like to weigh in on any of these things, you can reach me, of course, on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. .net. Regarding my monologue from last week, where I talked about the incriminating intelligence memo, Melinda on Facebook says, so scary to think we almost elected the candidate that was an integral part of this. We were headed directly to a fascist state with Obama at the helm to be handed over to Killery. Wow, you just can't make this stuff up unless you are C. Steele. Janine says, my reaction is sadness. Our once great country was so nearly tyrannical, and these people in high positions are so offended that we are stunned by their deception, lying, covert, dishonest chain of shame. Using our once great system for their own illegality and stunning misuse of law and power, they thought the public and fellow politicians would all be too dull to catch them. Devin Nunes is a hero. I hope he has bodyguards for his bodyguards. It has taken a while to break through the layers of lies. Steve says, let's lock him up in Gitmo, get the torches and pitchforks, head to D.C., take the Dems out in cuffs. Now, reacting to what I just did a few moments ago, the mock debate with a fool, Wayne says, you sound like a couple of longtime friends I have. Fran says, uh-huh, exactly, exasperating. It's like a hula hoop, goes round and round but doesn't get anywhere. Steve says, I am still laughing about that, Bob. That was so true, still crying from laughing so hard. Dan says, this kind of argument is exactly why I stay out of these things now. I've had people call me obscene names over circular arguments like this. No more. There's no convincing either side. A couple of my friends are rabid Democrats. They honestly think that if Hillary had been elected, there would be less controversy and fewer accusations of bad behavior. Tim says, I could not agree more. Unfortunately, I think some people forget that this quality is not restricted to any political ideology. Well, that's true, Tim. I have met conservatives who also do a poor job of debating, but these days it is the liberals who are trying to shut down debate. Sharon says, I wish I could share this, but no Democrat would believe their own faulty arguments. Republicans would just shake their heads in belief of the idiocy of arguing with them. Russ says, Ben Franklin said it nicely. A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Don't bother. These ideologies will either be convinced by facts and reality, or they won't. It is not your job. Now, regarding what I said about John McCain and his so-called bipartisanship, Joy says, John McCain makes me sick. I have never liked him. David says, he's a Republican. Russ says, one final grand act of appeasement by the senior progressive in the Senate. Mr. McCain served honorably in the military, obeying the Constitution and protecting his nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic. For that, he is to be commended and respected. I cannot say the same about his political career. Well, you're right, Russ. He did serve honorably, but I think that sometimes when somebody has a nice military record, they get a little too much mileage in politics. And that's the problem with McCain politically. He hasn't done anything heroic for a very long time. Well, a couple of weeks ago on this program, I started a series. We began it toward the end of the show called Why Would a Loving God Allow Suffering in the World? Something we talk about every few years because it's a question that burns on people's minds. I started it, and the couple of weeks that followed, I did not get a chance to finish it. Being on the air once a week and sometimes being driven by the news, and there's just been so much in the news lately, we did not have a chance to get back to it. I do want to spend some time getting back to it today. And I had started by saying that a lot of people will assume that a loving God could not possibly exist, and their evidence for that is that there's suffering and evil in the world. And they'll act as if suffering and evil is somehow a contradiction to the Bible. And you may recall that a couple of weeks ago, I began by saying that this is not a unique problem to the Bible. Any belief you have in God, whatever your religion, whatever your philosophy, whatever your belief in God, whoever this God is, this God obviously has some reason for allowing suffering and evil in the world. And how do we know that? Because there is suffering and evil in the world. If the Bible were a book that said, once you give your life to Jesus Christ, you're never going to suffer again, then obviously the first time a trial comes your way, that would disprove the Bible. This is not what the Bible teaches. As a matter of fact, the Bible goes out of its way to tell us that we're going to suffer. The theme is embedded in all kinds of books in the Bible, but there are actually three whole books of the Bible dedicated to the subject, the book of Job, the book of Ecclesiastes, and the book of 1 Peter. Many of the verses that I read tonight are going to be from 1 Peter, and we'll start from 1 Peter 4, 12 through 14. It says, dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. And we'll talk more about this when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. to offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Why is there suffering in the world if God is such a loving God? We want to begin by saying this is not a unique problem to the Bible, but people act like it is. My father, since I grew up in a Jewish family, disowned me when I became a Christian, refused to talk to me, pronounced me dead. A few months after that happened, I was visited by my favorite uncle, Uncle Norman, the brother of my dad. He, of course, did not want to disown me, which I appreciated. He took me out to Denny's to talk, to have lunch, to discuss things, and literally broke down weeping in the restaurant. And he wanted to know how I could possibly do this, how I could stab my dad in the back. I tried to tell him that it had nothing to do with any hostility toward my dad. It had nothing to do with any rebellion about the way I grew up. It's just that I had had an encounter with Jesus Christ. And of course, he was not able to relate to that or accept that at all. And he asked a question that gets asked by a lot of Jewish people. And one of the problems that Jewish people have with God today, and particularly Christianity, is the Holocaust. Now, a lot of that is understandable because some of the Nazis, many of the Nazis who persecuted Jews in the Holocaust, murdered Jews in the Holocaust, went to church. And one of the things that we need to point out as Christians is that there are people who use the name Christian who are not Christians. The guy that led me to Christ was smart enough and wise enough to say, Bob, the people that call the Jews Christ killers, they don't really believe in Jesus. Jesus, in his very first sermon, we call it the Sermon on the Mount. You can read about that in the Gospel of Matthew chapters 5 through 7. This is the first time we know of historically where Jesus preached. And toward the end of that sermon, he said something very important. He said, not everybody who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, meaning judgment day, he says, many will stand before me and say, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name do many glorious works? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. Now, when God says, I never knew you, obviously he's God. He knows them. He's not saying he didn't know who they were. He's not saying he didn't know their address. In Greek, that word to know, prognosko, could also refer to an intimate relationship. He's saying, you may have called yourselves Christians. You may have called yourselves my followers, but you did not have a relationship with me. Because if you had a relationship with me, your life would have changed and you would have been obedient. But it's understandable why Jewish people, and anybody who resists religious hypocrisy, is going to have this problem. But I'll never forget the question that my Uncle Norman put to me, because many Jewish people have put this question to Christians. He says, when 6 million Jews, men, women, babies, were murdered in concentration camps like Auschwitz, where was your Jesus? And I said to him, Uncle Norman, do you believe in God? He says, well, of course I believe in God. He said it very defensively. I said, okay, where was God? Forget Jesus. Where was God as you believe in him? Where was the God of the Old Testament? Where was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when 6 million Jews were murdered? He hesitated, and all at once he said, well, maybe I don't believe in God. I said, okay, maybe you don't, but don't make this out to be a unique problem to Christianity. This is a problem with any concept of God that we have. So getting back to Christianity, though, since we're claiming that the one true God of the universe revealed himself, does the Bible say anything about suffering? The Bible tells us why we suffer in general. We suffer in general because human beings turned away from God, wanted to run the planet by themselves, were given free will by God. Suffering is a result of our sin, which the Bible calls selfishness, that self-preservation where we put ourselves above others. So we are told why there's suffering in the world in general. What we're not told is why suffering gets proportioned the way it does. We're not told why some poor little four-year-old girl dies of leukemia and some mobster lives to be 90 years old. The Bible does not answer that question, but we are told that suffering is a result of sin. So when people say, well, why doesn't God do something about sin? Why doesn't God do something about suffering? My first answer is he did do something about it. He did it back in 33 AD when he became a man, when there was an incarnation, when he took on human flesh, when he called himself Jesus Christ, and when he was nailed to the cross. All of our sin, all the sin that every human being committed was put upon Jesus and was destroyed, and Jesus with it was destroyed on our behalf. He rose from the dead 3 days later. That's the great glorious hope, but it was destroyed. Now, of course, let's not be naive. If you're a Christian and you're listening right now and you're thinking you're going to go tell your skeptical friend this, you can probably guess, and you will be correct in guessing it, that your friend is not going to immediately accept this. They're going to say, oh, I'm asking why God allows suffering today, and you give me some cop-out answer about what God did 2,000 years ago. That's a cop-out. Evil still exists. Why doesn't God just come and wipe out all evil right now? Well, that sounds good. That certainly sounds good, but there's a couple of problems. The Bible says that all of us have a sin nature. Now, that's not the only nature we have. We have a good nature and we have a sin nature, but we have the sin nature, and the sin nature is an evil nature, which means all of us have evil in us. Some give into it more than others, but we all have an evil nature. Let me say that again. We all have an evil nature. So when somebody comes along and says, why doesn't God just wipe out all evil? You can say, okay, do you want him to start with you? Oh, well, no, I don't mean my evil. I mean everybody else. But the problem is if God were to wipe out all evil, nobody would be left. So what he did instead in his mercy was he wiped out evil through Jesus Christ. The Bible teaches that God is a just God and God is also a loving God. Justice says that sin has to be paid for. Love says God in his mercy doesn't want us to have to pay for it. The cross is the perfect demonstration of God's love and justice combined. So when Jesus Christ died on the cross, he's giving everybody an opportunity to look for the rest of their life, turn from their evil. And during that time, unfortunately, the ability to choose right includes the ability to choose wrong, or it's not a real ability. So at this point, your friend says, okay, well, I get it. Maybe God just can't come and wipe out all evil, but couldn't he at least restrain evil a little better? Well, I've got a couple of answers to that. First of all, he does a lot more than you would think. But there are reasons he doesn't restrain it completely, and we'll talk about that when we come back. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Looking for a book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a six-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? To alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Does a loving God allow evil in the world? Well, he doesn't. We're all going to stand before him someday, and we are going to answer to him. And what's interesting is this idea that we're all going to stand before God and answer to him. That is the second biggest objection. The first objection I get, the biggest objection I get from skeptics, is how can a loving God sit back, allow evil, and not do anything about it? Their second objection is, how could a loving God send people to hell? Now, I understand hell seems like a hideous doctrine, but when you stop and think about it for a moment, what is the doctrine of hell actually teaching? It's teaching that there will be a day of judgment where God comes down and says, I'm going to hold all of you accountable for the way you lived. And if you lived a life of suffering and causing suffering, inflicting suffering, committing evil, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. We would expect the same from a judge. Can you imagine some judge allowing a murderer or a rapist to go free? Would we not assume that that is an unloving and therefore irresponsible and therefore unjust judge? So people say, why would God sit back and allow suffering and evil? But then they complain when the Bible says, actually, God's not going to sit back. He's not going to allow. It's really interesting because most people who say they have problems with a God who would send people to hell, I'd like to ask them, well, do you have problems with a God who would send people to heaven? They go, no, I don't have a problem with heaven. I say, well, who's going to be in heaven? Oh, everybody. I say, oh, everybody. So Adolf Hitler's going to be in heaven. Genghis Khan's going to be in heaven. Idi Amin, Saddam Hussein, they're all going to be in heaven. Well, no, I don't mean them. Okay, well, where are they going to go? The problem, though, is it's easy to list these evil people, but as I mentioned before the break, all of us have a sinful nature, which means all of us have components of evil in us. And so whereas God is going to judge evil, he wants to also be merciful to those who are willing to turn from their evil. So we started by saying that in 33 AD, God did something about this. He came down, called himself Jesus Christ, died on the cross, rose from the dead 3 days later. And that's what he chose to do about sin. Now everybody has their entire life to accept Christ, accepting Christ being defined as turning from their sin, recognizing that whereas we can turn from our actions, we can't change our thoughts, we can't change our motives, we can't change our hearts, we can't change the kinds of emotions we wouldn't want anybody seeing, but we know God can read minds and God sees them. So we throw ourselves at the mercy of the court, at the mercy of God. And we say, send your Holy Spirit to come in and change us. That's what it means to give our lives to Christ. Now, if we don't do that, then a person is going to stand before God and they are going to end up in hell. So rest assured, God will deal with it. And you can take the path of his mercy and forgiveness, or you can take the path of his judgment. But one way or the other, God is going to deal with suffering and evil, which means he's going to deal with you. And so during this in-between time where he gives us our entire lives to accept or not accept Christ, we have free will. Now, at this point, some of my skeptical friends like to jump in and say, well, then that was unfair for God to give us free will because he knew some people would use their free will to commit evil, and he knew other people would use their free will to reject Christ and not accept Christ. And I say, well, that's irrelevant because they still have free will. And they say, well, God would have been more loving to not even give us free will. Why did God even bother to give us free will? Well, that's an interesting question, my friend, but it's an irrelevant question. And let me tell you why it's irrelevant, because God created you in such a way that you like your free will. You're grateful to have free will. Don't tell me you aren't. When you were in high school, you counted the days before you could get out from under your parents' wing, where there's no longer a curfew, where there are no longer lists of rules that you think are stupid. How many wars and revolutions have been fought in the name of freedom? Of course we like having a free will. God could have programmed us as robots. God could have made us marionettes on a string. He didn't. He gave us free will. I remember one time years ago, Billy Graham was on the Donahue Show. Some of you may not remember Donahue. He was like the format of the Oprah Winfrey Show and some of those daytime town hall type talk shows. Well, Phil Donahue was really the architect of that kind of show. And he had Billy Graham on. Billy Graham, I should tell you, is one of the few televangelists that I like. Radio evangelists are just fine, I should say. But I've never cared for the television evangelists. Too much talk about money and stuff. Billy Graham's always been pretty clean. So I was very interested a number of years ago when Billy Graham was on the Donahue Show. And Donahue started talking about the fact that the Bible teaches that we're not just sinful, but that we're born with a sinful nature. And Billy Graham says, that's true, but it's also true that if we give our lives to Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit will come upon us and change us and deliver us from our nature and forgive us from our sin. So God's going to do something about it. And Donahue goes, yeah, but it's still kind of a bad deal from God that we had to go through this at all. And then he asked a question that I hear from time to time, which sometimes gets shoved under the rug, but I actually think it's an interesting question. He says, do you believe there's life on other planets? And you could tell by the way Donahue asked that question that he was expecting Billy Graham to say, no, the Earth is the only world God created, and he created it in 6 days, blah, blah, blah. Well, much to surprise, Donahue didn't answer that way. He says, there's so many different planets in our galaxy that have been uncharted, and then there's so many galaxies. He says, I think it's very possible that there's life out there. And Donahue really had his interest. Now he goes, well, you mean intelligent life? Maybe human life? He said, maybe. He says, okay, well, let me ask you something. How would that relate to God? And Billy Graham says, well, there's only one God. So even if somebody was born on another planet, there's still one God. You know, it is kind of funny. A lot of times people say, well, what if some spacecraft came from another galaxy and landed on our planet, and the person said, there is no God? All that was mean was that we met an astronaut who didn't believe in God. We've already sent up our own astronauts who don't believe in God. But you can believe this. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. Suffering and evil in the world. This is our discussion today. Before we went to the break, I mentioned a time where Billy Graham, the evangelist, was on the Phil Donahue show, and Donahue was asking if he believed in life on other planets, and Graham said, I think it's very possible. So Donahue said, well, how would that relate to God? Graham said, there's only one God. And then he asked the zinger question, the one he was just waiting and salivating to hit him with. How would this relate to Jesus Christ? Aha! Would God expect these humanoids on another planet in another galaxy to give their lives to Jesus Christ? And Billy Graham said, well, that all depends on whether these people ever fell into sin. Graham says, what do you mean by that? He says, well, I'd like to believe that there's people out there that, unlike our human race, just never fell into sin. Now, that doesn't mean Jesus doesn't exist, and it doesn't mean they don't have a relationship with Jesus, but they always had the relationship with him. Because they had never sinned. And they don't need to accept him as their savior to forgive them because there's nothing to be forgiven of. They'd never sinned. At this point, Donahue got all snooty. He goes, whoa, boy, if there's planets like that out there, I'm kind of bummed that I wasn't born on one of those planets. I feel like I was kind of ripped off being born here on Earth. I think I got a bum steer from God. I'm unhappy about the way I was born. What can I do about that? At which point, Billy Graham said, if you're unhappy about the way you were born, you can become born again. You see, this is what these terms mean. So, yeah, human beings have free will. Now, I also mentioned that just because we understand that our own free will is responsible for suffering and evil, that doesn't mean that we've suddenly explained all the suffering, the evil in our lives. Sometimes natural catastrophes happen, such as what happened to Job, but that was the least of the problems. And Christians often make the error when they see a brother or sister suffering to jump in and give them all this trite, unsolicited advice. The Bible does not actually command us to go out and give unsolicited advice. We're not experts on the universe just for becoming Christians. We can learn about the Bible. The Bible's very significant. The Bible tells us where we came from, where we're going, what our future is, how to be forgiven of our sin, and a little bit about how to live in the meantime. The Bible tells us how to have a relationship with the God of the universe. That's not too shabby, but that doesn't mean we know everything. And we certainly don't immediately know why somebody is suffering. And when Job was laying on his bed, as if things weren't bad enough, four friends sit down, and one of them kept his mouth shut. Three of them for 7 days kept their big stupid mouth shut. But after 7 days, they just couldn't resist, and they started saying, well, Job, you must have done something to incur this. Now, Job was aware that he was a sinful man like anybody else, but he was not aware of anything specific that he had done to incur this, and he tried to tell his friends, you really don't know what you're talking about. But Job himself started getting kind of anxious, and we've all done this. We've all said, if only I had an audience with God. If only God would come down from heaven and visit me. If only I could talk to him. Oh, the questions I would ask him. And at the end of the book of Job, God comes and there's this big whirlwind. And it's actually very anticlimactic because God comes to Job and he says, I have a question for you, Job. You were going to ask me a question? Let me ask you a question. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the world. Oh, you weren't there? Well, that's my answer. I'm God, you're man. I don't have to tell you everything. I don't owe you an explanation. Now, that does not mean that the purpose of the book of Job was to tell us that there's no explanation when we suffer. It does mean that the purpose of the book of Job was to tell us that we will not always know what the explanation is. As a matter of fact, we, the reader, are treated to a peek behind the curtains, behind the scenes in the first two chapters, where Job, unbeknownst to him, is being talked about in the heavenlies, where God and Satan are conversing. And Satan says, you know, the only reason Job follows you is you've given him so many goodies. Take some of those goodies away. Let him suffer a little bit. And God says, okay, I will test Job. We will take some of these blessings away. We will allow him to suffer, and let's see what happens. So we, the reader, do know why Job went through that. But what's interesting is Job was never told, or if he was, it was not recorded in the book of Job. But that's not all that happened. God also took his three friends and said, you three did not know what you were talking about. Who are you to come and comment on why my servant Job is suffering? As a matter of fact, the three of you need to repent of your sins. So we don't always know the answers. Now, what would be my advice then when you're going through a trial? First of all, realize all Christians go through trials. Let me read this again. 1 Peter 4, starting with verse 12. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. So realize all Christians go through trials. If you're going through one, doesn't mean you've done anything wrong necessarily. Could be a problem, but you don't necessarily jump to that conclusion. What you do want to do, though, is as best as you can, determine the type of trial. And the Bible lists different types of trials. Sometimes a person is suffering for Christ's sake. As a matter of fact, when Peter wrote the book of 1 Peter, the kinds of trials he was talking about were persecution. Now, it's not always that. You can get sick, you can have car troubles, you can have relationship problems. The kinds of trials the church was going through that Peter was writing about is that they were being persecuted. And he acknowledged that. So there is such a thing as suffering for Christ's sake. And Peter says here in this same book, and I'm reading from chapter 3, verse 14, but even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. Jesus had said something on this, going back again to his Sermon on the Mount. I'm reading from Matthew 5, 11 and 12. Jesus says, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is Bob Siegel. I've been on the radio for many years, but let me tell you about a voice I've learned to appreciate far more than any radio announcers, Fred Falduti of Realty Executives All Area. Now, why do I care so much about Fred's voice? Because not long ago, Fred's voice spoke the following words to me.
Bob, I have some good news for you. They accepted your offer.
That's right. Fred Falduti just sold my house. With words like those, who needs radio? Folks, I'm telling you, choosing the right realtor is no small task. Fred took a personal interest in my situation, treating me less like a customer and more like a member of the family. And Fred's been doing this since 1994. Realty Executives All Area has sold thousands of homes locally.
Our footprints are throughout San Diego County, and we are proud of our accomplishments of assisting home sellers and buyers like you. Over the years, we've managed hundreds of real estate transactions and have encountered just about every kind of challenging situation possible.
That's it, folks. That's the voice that will sell your home. Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Falduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619-719-7717. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfalduti.com. We radio hosts love to talk, but let's face it, when have we ever sold your home? Fred Falduti will.
Bob Siegel's fantasy novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, is now available on Kindle, Nook, and in print copy. Check out some of the wonderful customer reviews on Amazon.com. Reviews such as this one. Wow, what an incredible story. Well-written, believable characters. The story takes twists and turns that keep surprising the reader. Although it is written from the perspective of a preteen, it is most appealing to an adult. Takes one back to those feelings and longing for adventure. I can't wait for the sequel. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
About why a loving God will allow us to go through trials. And right before we went to the break, I said, when you are going through a trial, try to determine the type of trial. Sometimes we're suffering for Jesus' sake. But Peter, the book of 1 Peter, the same book that acknowledged that there are times when we're persecuted for things we didn't do, also acknowledged that sometimes we're suffering for our own stupid sake. 1 Peter 4:15 says, if you suffer, it should not be as a murderer, or thief, or any other kind of criminal, or even as a meddler. The meddlers, that's what Job's friends were doing. They were meddling. So here's somebody that's suffering, and then somebody goes and meddles, and then they may suffer because they were meddling. I do want to encourage you, though, to not overanalyze a trial. If we're suffering because of something stupid we did, if we're suffering because we've sinned, and yes, we're God's children. Once when we give our lives to Jesus Christ, God has adopted us. God has become our parent. If we get out of line, he'll spank us. He'll take us through the divine woodshed. He will get our attention through trials. But ladies and gentlemen, when that happens, it's obvious. If you don't find some obvious thing that comes to your mind right away, well, then maybe it's just a season for a trial, like in the case of Job. Look at Jonah, for example. If ever there was an example of somebody who disobeyed God, it's Jonah. But if ever there's an example of somebody who had a great relationship with God, it's Jonah. The very fact that Jonah felt so comfortable to whine and complain like a spoiled little kid, but you look at the dialogues he had with God, we're saying, boy, this guy had an intimate relationship with the Almighty. But Jonah was also a whiny brat, and God said to Jonah one day, I want you to go and preach to the people of Nineveh. And Jonah decided he didn't want to do this. He got tired of preaching to people and telling them God was going to destroy them, and then a lot of times God in his mercy would let them live, and he wouldn't destroy them. And it bothered Jonah. He wanted to see God just go through and waste them and blow them up. So he tells him to go to Nineveh. Jonah gets on a boat and goes as opposite the direction of Nineveh as he can possibly go. Well, while this is happening, there's a great big storm. The boat looks like it's about to capsize. Jonah realizes that he's become a jinx. That's where the phrase Jonah and the phrase jinx has actually become synonymous. When they call somebody a Jonah, they get that from the story. Jonah finally said to the people, to throw me overboard. He was swallowed by some sea monster. I know a lot of people talk about Jonah and the whale. The word there in Hebrew was not actually whale. It was some sea monster. We don't know what it was. We do know that it was a miracle that he survived. And while he's alive in the belly of this thing, can you imagine Jonah going, gee, I wonder what the Lord is trying to tell me. I was having such a peaceful day. No, he knew just exactly what was going on. And of course, the fact that the big giant sea monster went and spit him up on the shores where he could then go walk to Nineveh was a big clue as well. The Apostle Paul was given what he called, and this was a nickname, a thorn in the flesh. It was some kind of physical infirmity. We believe it had something to do with his eyes because Paul writes in some of his letters as if he had visionary problems. And in Paul's case, he did have a clue. God actually told him why that happened. God had done something to Paul. And we read a lot of books. There's been some modern day books lately, like Heaven is for Real. And there's a lot of others on the bestseller list. where people have claimed that they've gone to heaven for a day. Paul made that claim. He said, I don't know if my body was caught up or if I was just there spiritually, but I experienced heaven. And when I came back, God was concerned that I was going to get puffed up with pride because of these great revelations he had given me. So he allowed me to be humbled. And he said, and I have this physical infirmity now. He says, three times I've gone to God and I've asked him to remove it from me. And God spoke finally and said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in your weakness. You got to catch the irony here, because there are a lot of faith healers who will go around saying, if you're not getting healed, it's only because you don't have faith. Oh, really? If the Apostle Paul didn't have faith, nobody had faith. He had faith, and he completely believed 100% that God could heal him at the drop of a hat. God told him why he didn't heal him. So Paul understood why he was going through that. But again, if nothing comes to mind, in Paul's case, he knew what God was trying to tell him. In Jonah's case, he knew what God was trying to tell him. In Job's case, he did not know what God was trying to tell him. Either did his friends. One of my seminary professors tells a story about a time where a couple of his seminary students came to visit him one day. They were newlyweds. And they said, boy, our plumbing just backed up in our basement. This was in Denver. They said, there's a cesspool in our basement. What do you think the Lord is trying to tell us? And he hesitated for a moment, and he finally said, well, I think the Lord is trying to tell you that he wants you to go home and clean up your cesspool. I remember one summer, everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong, from financial problems to car problems, you name it. And I remember often during that summer trying to say to God, what are you trying to teach me? And it finally occurred to me that God wasn't trying to teach me anything. Don't get me wrong. I need to learn a lot of lessons. And there's been all kinds of times where God has had to slap me up and down the side of the head, and he has had to teach me things. But in this particular case, at this particular moment of my life, it was nothing that I was doing. It was just a season for Bob to go through a trial. What I'm trying to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, is when you're going through a trial, aren't things bad enough already? Don't you make things worse when you try to analyze it? Finally, however, realize the trial will end. And at the end of this book that we spent so much time in today, 1 Peter, I'm reading now from 1 Peter 5:10. I love how he concludes, or we're close to the conclusion here. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. Now, I realize that depending on where you live or the unique dynamics of your life, sometimes this restoration does not happen till we get to heaven, but often it does happen right in this life. I'll never forget, this was after my first tour of full-time ministry. I had gone out to Arizona State University. I had lived in San Jose. I went out to Arizona State for a semester, and I was doing campus ministry. When I came back to San Jose, California for a couple of weeks of Christmas, I was going to go and speak to different churches, and all of a sudden I got really badly sick with a sore throat, Pepto-Bismol, swollen glands, the works. And at first I was wondering why God was allowing that to happen. And then I realized, don't think of God in terms of asking why he allowed it to happen. Just realize God's the knight in shining armor that's going to help you get out of this. Well, boy, he did. I went to the doctor. The doctor didn't charge me a cent for the call. That's got to be the greatest miracle since the parting of the Red Sea. We'll see you next week.
Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170, The Answer, is sponsored by Bob Siegel.